Hello and welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona for Time Magazine. My name is Matt Wren and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today we'll be reading selections from the February 10th issue. On the cover, a black and white photograph of Kobe Bryant standing with his back to the camera, with his head bowed down, a basketball in one hand, and the 24. In a sense, he's underlining the 24 with his hand behind his back. And it reads, Kobe Bryant, 1978. To 2020. We'll be starting off with an article that memorializes his life, and that is going to be written by, or is written, excuse me, by Sean Gregory. We'll also look at an article about containing coronavirus, and so hopefully it'll fill us in and give us some background of what's going on and what we can learn from it. And as always, we'll be looking at some smaller articles and some briefer articles, at least, from The Brief and The View, articles and essays that'll take us literally around the world and the country. So let's go ahead and begin with our cover story, which is written by Sean Gregory. Jerry West saw something the other basketball mavens didn't. Everyone around the league was intrigued by the slender high school senior with NBA genes and confidence to spare. But could Kobe Bryant really go directly from leading the Lower Merion High School Aces in suburban Philadelphia to guarding Michael Jordan? It took West, then executive vice president of the Los Angeles Lakers and one of the best players in NBA history, less than a half an hour to know the answer. As part of a workout ahead of the 1996 draft, Bryant played one-on-one against the recently retired defensive specialist Michael Cooper. The GM ended the session early. I was embarrassed for Michael to watch a 17-year-old just basically demolish him, West tells Time, and enjoy doing it. West acquired Bryant in a draft day deal, pairing the teenager with the towering Shaquille O'Neal and launching one of the most decorated careers in professional sports. Over 20 seasons, all of them with the Lakers, Bryant won 5 NBA championships, 2 scoring titles, a pair of Olympic gold medals, 1 MVP award, and was named to 18 All-Star teams. More than merely guarding Jordan, Bryant emerged as his heir, a scoring assassin who could rip a defender's heart out by way of a devastating dunk or an elusive fadeaway jump shot from the baseline, his singular work of athletic art. His ascent coincided with the development of social media and basketball's embrace around the world, which turned Bryant into one of the game's first truly global stars. Back home, he inspired a generation of high school phenoms, like LeBron James, to follow his lead from high school to the NBA. You said Kobe, and everyone knows who that is, a one-word name, says Quentin Richardson, who played against Bryant in the 2000s. Driven by a focus and intensity that he would come to call, and trademark, Mamba mentality, Bryant had the rare combination of elite talent and preternatural fire seen only in the true greats. Kobe played the game, says West, like it was war. When Bryant retired in 2016, he had scored 33,643 points, good for fourth on the NBA all-time scoring list. He was in third until January 25th, when James passed him. Bryant called James and sent a congratulatory tweet. The next day, Bryant was gone. The helicopter he was taking to his daughter's youth basketball tournament, crashed in the hills near Calabasas, California. All 9 people on board were killed, including Bryant's 13-year-old daughter, Gianna, known as Gigi, and 2 other young girls. Bryant had begun using helicopters as a player to avoid L.A. traffic on his commutes to home games and to give him more time with his wife, Vanessa, and their children. The crash is still under investigation, though the National Transportation Safety Board said the helicopter was not equipped with a terrain warning system that could have alerted the pilot to danger. The loss was one of the most stunning in the history of sports and global celebrity that Bryant had done so much to fuse. To many, it was as if a vein had been opened. NBA players wept publicly. On Weibo, one of China's largest social networks, the hashtag for Bryant's death drew nearly 2.5 billion views in a day. Former President Barack Obama said, Kobe was a legend on the court and just getting started in what would have been just as meaningful a second act. And world leaders from Israel to Venezuela shared their own condolences. Murals of Bryant with his daughter appeared in states from Texas to Massachusetts. Across the Philippines, skyscrapers lit up in tribute. In Los Angeles, thousands gathered to cry and light candles outside the downtown Staples Center, the house that Kobe Bryant built, as host Alicia Keys called it at the top of a notably subdued Grammy Awards held in the arena that night. It has become a gathering place for Bryant's legions of fans, who come bearing jerseys and balls, much the way Buckingham Palace overflowed with flowers following the death of Princess Diana. Reactions to Bryant's death have deepened to reflect the dimensions and sometimes confounding complexity of his life. Though not cut down in the prime of his basketball career, Bryant, at 41, was well into a second act that gave him more prominence than many active players. He had already written an Oscar-winning animated short film, launched a production company, created a sports academy, and become a vocal champion of women's sports. "I absolutely believe he was going to do great things," says Richardson, "and write another chapter of greatness after basketball." And he died being a parent. As word emerged that Gigi had been killed with him, queasiness was compounded by recognition. Every weekend, parents travel with their children to organized youth sporting events, just like Bryant was doing with the second of his four daughters. Suddenly, people who did not know Bryant or particularly care for him could picture themselves in his place and choke up. To toggle between Instagram and Twitter in the days after January 26th was to experience the social media version of awake. Gigi dangling from her father's shoulders, or parked above them, her hands resting on his head. The two sitting courtside, exploring the nuances of the game. Bryant's biography included another critical element. In 2003, he was arrested and charged with sexual assault. The criminal case was dropped after Bryant's accuser refused to testify in court. A civil suit ended with a settlement. Bryant issued a statement of apology, which read in part, "After months of reviewing discovery, listening to her attorney, and even her testimony in person, I now understand how she feels that she did not consent to this encounter." The case failed to derail Bryant's career, and by the time he retired, it tended to be mentioned reluctantly, if at all, in assessments of his legacy. In the era before hashtag MeToo, an NBA superstar could commute between games and court appearances without apparent consequence. Bryant was the son of former NBA player Joe Jellybean Bryant and Pamela Bryant. He spent part of his childhood in Italy, where his father played professionally, and where he learned both a language and a love of soccer. The family eventually settled outside of Philadelphia, where Bryant grew into a phenom. He was self-confident and solitary, which disarmed teammates. At the 1998 All-Star Game in New York, Bryant, then 19, went right at Jordan in what was a clear generational shift. After Jordan retired from the Bulls, the Lakers of Shaq and Kobe won three straight NBA titles from 2000 to 2002. Bryant and O'Neal had an inevitable falling out. Not even L.A.'s sprawl could contain those two alpha egos. When, in 2004, O'Neal was traded to Miami, many blamed Bryant, painted as a selfish ball hog and whose reputation was tainted by his criminal case. Bryant chose to embrace the role of villain, creating the Mamba mentality pop philosophy. It was an approach to life that required extreme focus, discipline, and enthusiasm for taking on all comers. Magic Johnson's perpetual smile didn't fit Bryant's style. Like Jordan, Bryant embraced brutal honesty and could be cruel to underperforming teammates. The Lakers suffered some down years in the mid-aughts, but Bryant's displays of individual excellence continued to make noise. In 2006, he scored 81 points in a game, the second highest point total in league history. Around that time, Jerry Colangelo, the head of USA Basketball, told Bryant that if he wanted to play for his first Olympic team, he'd have to serve primarily as a passer, not as a shooter. Bryant, though surprised, still promised Colangelo he'd do whatever was needed to bring a gold medal back to the U.S. Winning was always paramount. Colangelo was testing Bryant. The pair then shared a laugh, knowing that asking Bryant not to score was like asking a dog not to bark. At an early training camp for those Beijing Olympics, Bryant arrived in the weight room before 6 a.m. Younger superstars like James and Dwayne Wade, according to Colangelo, learned to follow Bryant's example. In China, where Bryant first hosted a clinic in 1998, hordes of people would greet the U.S. team bus. "They didn't want to see us," says Colangelo. "They wanted to see Kobe. They just kept chanting, Kobe, Kobe, Kobe. The U.S. won gold in Beijing. A Lakers renaissance followed. Los Angeles won back-to-back titles in 2009 and 2010, and Bryant was MVP of both finals. He continued to produce, but injuries plagued the last few years of his career. The 2015-16 goodbye season served as both farewell and affirmation of his basketball greatness. In a full Mamba showing that was replayed on national television in prime time a day after his death, Bryant scored 60 points on 50 shots at the Staples Center in the final game of his career. Rather than jump to TV or hawk products after his playing days, Bryant embraced the clean slate. He dedicated time to his venture capital firm, created a musical podcast for children, and won his Oscar for Dear Basketball, an animated film based on the poem he used to announce at the end of his playing career. In addition to supporting women's sports, Bryant was a regular presence and a cheerleader for the WNBA and U.S. Women's National Soccer and Gymnastics teams, among others. He became a devoted coach for his own daughters. He embraced the role, telling Jimmy Kimmel that his goal was to give the girls a foundation of the amount of work and preparation that it takes to be excellent. We lost a big advocate for women's sports, soccer icon Mia Hamm tells Time. But we're all inspired by his belief in equality, and it's our job to continue to move forward. She is among the many who believe Bryant's best was ahead of him, which only added to the despair over his death. When athletes hang up their uniforms, they're supposed to return to mortal life and age with the rest of us. They show up at ceremonies, hair a little bit more salty, but the applause as raucous as ever. I had a brother killed in Korea, and honestly, says West, it affected me in the same way. The NBA silhouette logo is modeled after West in his playing days. A petition to change it to Bryant's likeness has since received close to 3 million signatures. And I want to add to tribute to Kobe Bryant, I guess, by reading a viewpoint. This is written by Yvette Dion, who is the editor-in-chief of Bitch Media and the author of the forthcoming book, Lifting as We Climb, Black Women's Battle for the Ballot Box. In the wake of Kobe Bryant's untimely death at 41, the usual cascade of emotions set in. Disbelief, shock, sadness, and, for some, anger. That last emotion was born not from what was said about the superlative basketball star and doting father, but what wasn't. Rarely did the outpouring of tribute stop to acknowledge that amid the many wonderful accomplishments, Bryant did something horrific. In July 2003, Bryant was charged with sexually assaulting a 19-year-old employee of the Lodge and Spa at Cordillera in Edwards, Colorado. He admitted that he didn't explicitly ask for consent and initially denied even having sex with a woman. He left a bruise on her neck and drew blood from her skin. After Bryant's defense team badly intimidated the victim and smeared her reputation, she refused to testify. After the criminal case was dismissed, Bryant issued an apology that said, in part, "After months of reviewing discovery, listening to her attorney, and even her testimony in person, I now understand how she feels that she did not consent to this encounter." He later settled for an undisclosed sum in a civil suit. It is irresponsible to excuse or gloss over Bryant's treatment of this woman or his complicity in a legal strategy that upended her life. But it is also reductive to focus only on this behavior when reflecting on his life and death. When I learned of the helicopter crash, I immediately thought about my older brother yelling, "Kobe," whenever he threw makeshift paper basketballs into a trash can. I thought about Bryant's widow Vanessa and their fatherless daughters, who now have to move through life with a hovering cloud of grief. I thought about the many black children and families who saw Bryant as a model of possibility. And I thought about the woman who accused Bryant of rape, having to watch her perpetrator being valorized for eternity. The Me Too movement has helped equip us with more nuanced understanding of sexual violence. A person can be good to their spouse and their children, donate lots of money to worthy causes, and create indelible work that influences and also be a monster. And yet it's still difficult to process legacy in the face of tragedy. Thanks to the pressures of social media, on which we react to unfathomable news in real time, we often fall into a binary of good or bad, wrong or right, on the side of survivors or on the side of a rapist. It is rarely that simple. Bryant, aged and matured, became an ambassador for women's sports, coached his daughter's basketball team, and took pride in being a girl dad. But none of his commitments to his children, to women's sports, to a more equitable world negate his culpability. We must confront the tragedy that has befallen Bryant and his family, understand the greatness he exhibited on the court, and finally, maybe for the first time, reckon with the irreparable trauma he inflicted. When we are wedded to specific narratives of how feminists are supposed to act, it can be all too easy to disregard humanity. But feminism, at least the tradition I follow, makes space for redemption, too. Only Bryant's accuser can decide if she forgives him, and it's not our place to do that work publicly on her behalf. What we can do is complicate these conversations so we can usher in more honesty about who's elevated in the aftermath of a sexual assault and how fame and money insulate perpetrators from being brought to account. We can do this while still acknowledging that Bryant did not deserve to die in such a manner at such an age and that the people who loved him are grieving. And next we turn to an article written by Alice Park and Charlie Campbell. It's entitled Containing a Crisis. Are we doomed to a future of relentless viral outbreaks? The year of the rat is off to an ominous start. We just stay home and don't go out, says Mr. Dong. The 33-year-old researcher, who provided only one name, has no other options. He, his wife, and their 3-month-old daughter live in Wuhan, the epicenter of an unfolding global health crisis. They're treating the forced time at home as a holiday, though, he says, this is different than any of them before. Families like his huddle in their homes, fearful that if they venture out, they will get sick. Since the first cases of a previously unknown pneumonia-like illness emerged in December, Wuhan, the capital of Hubei province, has frozen in place. 10-lane thoroughfares lie empty after a ban on personal cars, and buses and subways sit silent. Lunar New Year 2020 was stripped of its traditional fireworks, boisterous gatherings around overflowing tables of food and drink, and happy reunions with family and friends. As researchers and public health officials scramble to learn as much as they can about the new virus, how easily it transmits among people, and how deadly it is, fears swamp this city of 11 million. The disease responsible is caused by a coronavirus that's never infected people before. Conflicting advice about how infectious the virus might be are swirling through the internet, along with misinformation about exactly where the virus, dubbed 2019-nCoV, came from. Hospitals in Wuhan are besieged by the sick, and only a handful of clinics are able to test for the disease. Coronaviruses make up a family of viruses that live mainly in animals. Bats are a favorite, but also include strains that contribute to the common cold in people. Only recently have they become more threatening, causing 2 deadly global pandemics in the past 2 decades. Severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, in 2002 and 2003, and Middle East respiratory syndrome, or MERS, in 2012. Each new outbreak adds a fresh urgency to the question of whether public health officials could be doing more to confront the threat from emerging infections in general, and coronaviruses in particular. The numbers will have climbed by the time you read this, but as of January 29th, the new virus has claimed at least 133 lives and sickened more than 6,000 people across 18 countries, including at least 5 cases in the U.S. While the World Health Organization, or WHO, has not declared, I will call it the WHO, has not declared a public health emergency of international concern, which would entail more stringent monitoring and containment of infected people, China's President Xi Jinping is treating it as a national emergency. He ordered an unprecedented quarantine of Wuhan, banning travel in and out of the city on January 22nd. A few days later, he extended the quarantine to 12 cities in Hubei province. Xi also took the unusual step of extending the official Lunar New Year holiday to discourage millions from traveling back to work and further seeding new infections around China. Faster than the virus itself, fear has spread around the globe. In the U.S., designated airports quickly instituted screening programs to identify passengers on Wuhan-originating flights with signs of fever, cough, or difficulty breathing, and to immediately direct them to hospital isolation wards. Numerous airlines canceled flights to and from China. Asian stock markets that weren't closed for the Lunar New Year plummeted. In the U.S., Europe, and Asia, shortages of surgical face masks were reported. The emergence of a powerful new infectious virus for which there is, as yet, no vaccine should scare us, of course. But at the same time, humans are better equipped to fight these kinds of outbreaks than ever before. New technologies, specifically ones that make possible the sequencing of any living thing's genetic blueprint, are finally giving us a meaningful advantage over microbes. We can map the genome of a virus, for example, which provides valuable clues about how it spreads and helps us figure out how our immune systems can best battle it. The finest scientific minds are doing just that with coronaviruses in the hope that epidemics do not have a chance to mushroom into pandemics. The question now is how quickly we can transmit that knowledge to every corner of the world, especially to China, where in some places the flow of information is tightly controlled by a paranoid state. Researchers in London and Hong Kong have already warned that Beijing has dramatically underestimated the number of cases in Wuhan. For any disease outbreak, the best strategy is transparency, says Yanzhong Huang, senior fellow for global health at the New York City-based Council on Foreign Relations. Even taking into account the potential for panic, you need people to be prepared. With a government as opaque as China's, can we be sure that we are? Coronaviruses are not rare. In fact, you might have one right now. Depending upon the year, anywhere from 10 to 30% of the annual burden of colds can be blamed on one of four coronaviruses. That's why, until the early 2000s, the scientific community treated coronaviruses primarily as nuisances and paid relatively little attention to them. 20 years ago, people weren't thinking in terms of coronaviruses being potential causes of pandemics or respiratory disease, says Dr. Ian Lipkin, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. That changed in 2002, when SARS first emerged from China. Of the 8,000 people ultimately confirmed to have the respiratory disease, up to 10% died, waking public health experts to the dangers of a virus that had jumped from bats to cats and dogs, and then to people. In Wuhan, officials believe 2019-2019-nCoV made such a leap inside the city's Huanan market. Rows of blue stalls housed countless purveyors of exotic wild animals for consumption. I saw live hedgehogs, porcupines, that kind of thing, says Alan Lane, 57, a physics teacher from the UK who has lived in Wuhan since 2002. It wasn't exactly hidden. The market has been shuttered since January 1st, though officials in white hazmat suits continued to sift through evidence when time visited on January 22nd. Movement across species is what makes virus experts nervous. Because of their sloppy genetic copying, viruses mutate all the time. By chance, the new aberrations sometimes make a strain more adept at living in a new host, and in some cases, those changes make it more virulent as well. In some respects, the outbreak in Wuhan might have been inevitable. Ralph Barrick, professor of epidemiology at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and an expert on the genetic sequences of coronaviruses, has worked with Chinese researchers since 2002 to better understand this family of microbes and how its members infect human cells to cause major respiratory symptoms. From bats, Barrick and his team extracted a series of coronaviruses that vary genetically from SARS by anywhere from 2 to 12%. Those differences hinted that some were primed to jump from bats to people and cause serious disease. His findings should have rung alarm bells, he says. We made strong predictions that those coronaviruses were poised for reemergence in human populations. In December, that prediction came true, when a mysterious pneumonia-like illness began spreading in the city of Wuhan. It's not a mystery how authorities should respond to a new infectious disease. By and large, it's been the same for thousands of years. Since typhoid fever struck Athens in 430 BC, among the first recorded outbreaks, to the Black Plague in Europe during the 1300s, and the more contemporary 1918 influenza pandemic, isolation and quarantine have been the most effective ways to contain a highly contagious infectious agent and prevent it from decimating an entire population of people. Yet in China, those lessons weren't always followed, despite the recent legacy of SARS. Although scientists in China quickly identified the new coronavirus, public health officials were slow to advise people about how best to protect themselves. It took President Xi nearly a month after the first cases emerged in Wuhan to finally address the health crisis publicly, and local health officials say that delay tied their hands. As Wuhan Mayor Zhou Shanwang explained on CCTV on January 27th, "As a local official, I could only disclose information after being authorized by the central government. A lot of people don't understand this." Indeed, the wife of a doctor in a Wuhan hospital told Time that her husband had been instructed not to discuss the coronavirus situation and the government's response with anyone. The top-down leadership structure of Xi's government leaves local health departments with little authority to issue alerts or take any action, snarling public health and politics at the expense of human lives. Train conductors were reportedly initially told not to wear masks to avoid generating more panic among passengers, just days before the entire rail system was shut down. "People didn't realize the severity of the situation," says a graphic designer from Wuhan who provided only her last name, Dao. "They thought the virus was controllable and not contagious. The government did not publish the facts in time, and they failed to control the epidemic." The swing from downplaying the initial cases to the extreme policies now in place fueled outbursts on the social media network Weibo. "The common people are suffering. We don't really have democracy here, and we are deprived of the right of telling the truth," wrote one Weibo user on January 28th. Another, on the same day, went further, seeing the outbreak as a harbinger of the future of the Chinese state. "The virus outbreak exposes the truth. It is a wake-up call. Our country is not as strong as we expected. Our system is not as superior as TV describes." Xi's government has done at least one indisputably effective thing to help battle the virus. On January 10th, it posted online a scientific paper containing the genetic blueprint of 2019-nCoV. The prompt release of the sequence won Xi plaudits in the global health community, since it allowed teams around the world to begin breaking down the ingredients of the infection and figuring out how to fight it. When SARS hit, the sequencing of the human genome was costly and cumbersome. In part because of that, in 2002, it took the Beijing government 5 months to release what it did in just a few days in 2020. Today, the technology is cheap and routine and is already speeding detection of new cases. When the first potential case of 2019-nCoV appeared in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, was able to confirm the fingerprint of the new coronavirus overnight from the patient's sample sent to the agency. The CDC also plans to ship testing kits to health departments, both in the U.S. and abroad, to enable them to quickly confirm coronavirus infections and distinguish them from the current seasonal flu. Diagnosing a disease is one thing, but treating it is another, and creating a vaccine or drug will take longer. To find out exactly which proteins the virus is using to wreak havoc requires making high-quality synthetic DNA from the viral genome, something only a few companies are able to do in a process that takes around 10 days. Then, researchers need to make proteins from that DNA. Without those proteins from the viral genome, you can't test which antibodies or drug compounds might counteract them. "The genetic code on a screen doesn't get you things to work with on the bench," says Carla Satchel, co-director of the Center for Structural Genomics of Infectious Diseases at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Scientists shouldn't be relying on private companies in this way, says Andrew Meskar, a coronavirus researcher and head of biochemistry at Purdue University, who researches coronaviruses. He is currently working on a solution. He and his team have studied the proteins, or enzymes, that different strains of coronavirus use to replicate in human cells, and have developed 50 compounds that can inhibit their activity, essentially blocking the virus from causing infection. "My idea is to have an IBM Watson of drug discovery," he says. "As soon as we get the sequence information for a new disease-causing virus, I can feed the computer the information, and it will say you should try these compounds off the shelf to start. It's not here yet, but it's coming, and I hope this is realized in my lifetime." And if I may take a quick moment to interrupt my reading, and thank you very much for joining me today. My name is Matt Rinn, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we are reading selections from Time Magazine, dated February 10th. And now to finish up the article, a little bit more to go. Yet, even if researchers identify a potential drug for 2019-nCoV, testing its safety and efficacy will take months. To speed that process up, scientists are tapping some new technologies. For example, stem cells can be coaxed to churn out high volumes of human lung cells in order to study how a virus like 2019-nCoV interacts with them. And three-dimensional cell cultures, which mimic in a lab dish the physical and molecular environment in the human body, could substitute for some early human safety studies, making for a more affordable and efficient way to test how safe a treatment might be. Advances like these make some in the field hopeful that the public health response could be better this time around. Twitter and everything was lighting up on Friday night, January 10th, that the genetic sequence of the virus was posted, says Meskar. We analyzed the first one that Saturday morning. Within 20 minutes of having the sequence, I knew it was very close to SARS. That's when I thought, uh-oh, this could be as virulent as SARS. That tells you right away that you had better act like this is SARS. There's still a lot about the Wuhan coronavirus that researchers don't know, however. It's not clear how easily the virus spreads from person to person or how long its incubation period is. And there are reports from Chinese health officials that it can be spread by someone who is infected but doesn't have any symptoms of the illness. The CDC and other health agencies are trying to confirm that right now. Both U.S. and Chinese scientists are also working on developing a vaccine for that virus, 2019-nCoV, relying on some of the genetic knowledge they gathered from SARS. All the science in the world still might not be a match for human nature, however, as personal fears often take precedence over the public good, especially during an unfolding outbreak when health officials don't have all the answers. When Jacob Wilson, who runs a media company in Wuhan, first felt his throat get scratchy on January 21st, he wasn't concerned. The 33-year-old from Alexandria, Louisiana, hadn't visited the seafood market that was being targeted as the source of the outbreak. And health authorities in Wuhan said the new mysterious pneumonia-like illness wasn't passed between humans. Reassured, Wilson continued going to work. But for the next 3 days, I had a fever and dry cough, which turned into an upper respiratory infection, sneezing, runny nose, and then muscle soreness, weakness, and sharp pains throughout my chest, he says. Unsure whether he was infected with 2019-nCoV or the flu, he decided to wait it out rather than brave a potentially infectious line of people at the hospital for several hours. It just seemed absolutely terrifying and unsafe, he says. Even if he had gone to the hospital, he might not have learned if he had 2019-nCoV. Only 4 medical centers in the entire city had kits to test for the virus at the time. He turned instead to his mother, a nurse in the U.S., who prescribed antiviral and asthma medications that improved his symptoms about after a week. He and the roughly 50 million people stuck in Hubei province are still facing a quarantine period that looks likely to drag into weeks and possibly months as the numbers of infections and deaths creep higher. With workplaces shuttered and no way to earn money, locals are counting their meals and trying to remain positive. This break is peace and quiet, says Dong. People may feel bored, but I enjoy this holiday. Until science offers a better remedy, the people of Wuhan must cling to those simplest of defenses, hope and hiding. And I'll add on a small sidebar under protecting yourself. Use these CDC tips to prevent the spread of that virus and other respiratory viruses. Wash hands often using soap and water. Avoid touching eyes, nose, and mouth. Avoid close contact with those who are sick. Disinfect frequently touched surfaces. Cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue. Next is a longish essay written by Justin Warland from Davos, Switzerland. The world of finance groggily awakens to climate change. For years, climate activists have warned that a warming planet would bring devastation, disrupting not only developing countries and coastal communities, but also the foundations of the global economy. Still, investors continued to pump billions of dollars into fossil fuels. Governments prioritized policies to keep cheap oil flowing, and developers build on land that scientists say will soon be underwater. Kristalina Georgieva, 66, the environmental economist who took the helm as managing director of the International Monetary Fund in October, has spent much of her career studying the problem. Now, she says, a slew of climate-related disasters have finally awakened the financial sector and the economic leaders who guide it. The tide is turning, she told Time in a January 23rd interview at the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Georgieva plans to take advantage of this moment. The new chief of the IMF described a range of measures the global financial institution will take to prioritize climate change during her five-year term, supporting policies that require investors to disclose climate vulnerability, measuring a country's financial situation in part by its preparation for climate change, pushing countries around the globe to implement a carbon tax. We have to create the right policy environment that is based on sound economics, she says. I'm prioritizing this for the fund. At a time when much of the climate conversation centers on flashy policy prescriptions like the Green New Deal proposed by congressional Democrats, the climate policy of the IMF and the changing tune of the financial sector may sound wonky. But the climate challenge is unlikely to be met without the financial sector and the authorities that regulate and govern it on the right side of the fight. For decades, banks have given fossil fuel companies the financing to mine and drill. Meanwhile, governments have provided seemingly bottomless subsidies, some $5 trillion annually, the IMF said last year. At the same time, banks have largely ignored the risk that climate change poses to their customers, from businesses in the flood zone to homes in fire-prone areas. At Davos, there are hints this may be changing. Just a few days before the conference, BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, said climate change would lead to a fundamental reshaping of finance, and promised to rethink its strategy. Microsoft pledged to go carbon negative in a decade and remove, by 2050, a sum of carbon equivalent to all that the company has ever emitted. The value of assets under management in the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance, a group of investors committed to having a zero emissions portfolio by 2050, grew to more than $4.3 trillion. And the IMF warned that climate change already endangers health and economic outcomes. I don't want to be naive, but I want to acknowledge that the center of the global economy is now saying things that many of us have dreamed they might for a long time, former Vice President Al Gore said at a dinner in Davos convened by WWF. They're saying them forcefully and eloquently. Two broad climate risks dominated the discussion among corporate executives and investors in Davos, physical risk and so-called transition risk. The former is obvious. Climate change drives extreme weather events and disasters, from flooding and drought to wildfires and heat waves, which can destroy infrastructure and devastate economies. IMF data shows that even 7 years after a devastating tropical storm, a country's GDP per capita remains 1% lower than it would have been otherwise. Transition risk refers to the possibility that companies may get left behind as the world goes green. The industry driven out of business by new regulation, for example, or the technology made obsolete by new advances. Not to mention the brand tarnished by growing activist and consumer revolt. Companies have been aware of these risks for years, in some cases decades, but executives have always seen managing them as a balancing act. Move too quickly and risk leaving behind your core business. Move too slowly and risk getting left behind. But the swiftness and severity of recent climate events, along with the growing social pressure, have made the biggest companies and investors realize they've been too conservative, leaving them out of step with colossal changes that are already underway. The degree of capital reallocation and the speed of that is going to be larger and happen more quickly than most market participants expect, Brian Deese, BlackRock's global head of sustainable investing, told Time in Davos. Georgieva wants to nudge the system along to make countries and companies acknowledge the threat climate change poses to their bottom lines. For years, the IMF has tested small islands for their exposure. This year, it will do the same for Japan, building on pilots done in other advanced economies. At Davos, she endorsed the work central banks are doing to measure how climate change might impact portfolios. Tackling climate change isn't all bad news for the economy, Georgieva says, as a transition to clean energy sources creates new economic opportunity. If we really have the courage to move, it may be the silver bullet that boosts the economy, she says. The newfound urgency of the climate discussion at Davos reflects the reality facing economic leaders. Nonetheless, challenges remain. So far, it's mostly just talk, of course. And for all the executives and investors who say they will tackle climate change, there are others who want to squeeze out the last few dollars in the fossil fuel era. This is a whole-of-economy transition, and in every sector of the economy, there are companies that will be part of the solution, and there will be companies that, for whatever reason, lag. Mark Carney, governor of the Bank of England, said at a panel hosted by Bloomberg in Davos. The companies that have made bold promises still need to deliver on them. As the teenage activist Greta Thunberg said in perhaps her most publicized moment of the week, pretty much nothing has been done since the global emissions of CO2 have not reduced. In fact, global temperatures are on track for a rise of 3 degrees Celsius since the Industrial Revolution, even if governments follow through on their current commitments, blowing past the Paris Agreement's target of keeping the temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius. Jennifer Morgan, executive director of Greenpeace International, described the dynamic as a tension between companies that see themselves as part of the solution and an old energy driving companies that operate with business-as-usual assumptions. A Greenpeace International report released during Davos showed that 24 banks in attendance this year financed the fossil fuel industry to the tune of $1.4 trillion from the adoption of the Paris Agreement to 2018. Even as some investors start to step up to change that tide, Georgieva says the transition needs a push from leaders in government, beyond voluntary disclosures of climate risks. To accelerate progress toward low-carbon, climate-resilient investments, it would be prudent to move toward mandatory disclosure, the Bulgarian said. It is a welcome sign that some central banks are going in that direction. For all the ardent declarations of intention at Davos, the true test lies in the months to come. This year will be a critical test of global commitments as governments prepare to make new pledges to reduce emissions ahead of November's UN Climate Conference in Glasgow. Davos was a good start. Leaders are talking. Now they need to act. And next up is another essay. This was entitled Trump's Middle East Plan Acknowledges Israel's Primacy. And this is written by longtime columnist for Time magazine Ian Bremmer. The Trump administration's Israel-Palestine peace plan tears up the playbook of prior U.S. policy. Rather than fairness, it is built upon the recognition of Israeli power on the ground and shifts in the region's geopolitics. With continued expansion over the past two decades, Israelis have been making the West Bank their own. The plan also underscores the reality that Palestinian leaders have lost the active support of much of the Arab world, many of whose leaders would like to work more closely with Israel on countering Iran and other initiatives. For Palestinians, the plan imposes Israeli bargaining positions from earlier negotiations, a nominally sovereign state of Palestine with a capital on the outskirts of East Jerusalem. Both Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his chief rival, Benny Gantz, are on board. The Trump team is wagering that more geopolitical honesty will change the game in the region. Previous U.S. governments presented themselves as neutral arbiters between Israelis and Palestinians. Neither side took that claim seriously. This new deal aims to contain, rather than reduce, Israeli settlements, giving Palestinians a smaller plot of land for their state, about 70% of the West Bank. Once the plan is formally implemented by the Israeli government, Israel would freeze settlement construction for 4 years in areas that would become the state of Palestine. Taken within the context of the rest of Trump's foreign policy, this deal is an outlier. The plan is detailed and thoughtful, unlike the agreement announced with North Korea. Most surprising, one of the most unilaterally oriented administrations has taken a multilateral approach to resolving one of the world's thorniest conflicts by getting other Arab states to buy into the proposal. To entice the Palestinians, the Trump administration has pledged to drum up investments of $28 billion over 10 years to support Palestine, with $22 billion of additional funding going to Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon. Many Palestinians will likely not accept anything that smells like a payoff, especially when it includes so many poison pills. First, before Palestinians can unlock any benefit, the Hamas government in Gaza must renounce its anti-Israel ideology or somehow be removed from power. Second, the Trump plan would allow the state of Palestine to build a capital on the outskirts of East Jerusalem, but only in areas east of the existing separation barrier. Third, the state of Palestine would control just 70% of the West Bank, in contrast to the 94-96% proposed by Bill Clinton in 2000. Finally, the administration's limits on the Palestinian right of return, even within a sovereign Palestinian nation, is a serious obstacle for any truly free country. It's clear that this proposal will not lead to peace in the coming months, or maybe ever. The Palestinians rejected the plan, and their leaders will make their anger clear. According to my conversations with senior Trump administration officials, they have already told Israeli and Arab leaders the territory is specifically open for negotiation should the Palestinians decide to engage after having refused to talk for more than 2 years. This plan is central to Trump's Middle East strategy. As the conflict becomes more marginal to the interests of the region's key actors, and the U.S. has generally become less interested too, Arab-Israeli normalization is only a matter of time, and the Palestinians are at risk of missing that train. The next piece is an article from the Brief section, and it's written by Melissa Chan. Harvey Weinstein's New York City rape and sexual assault trial opened in dramatic fashion. Lines formed before dawn outside the Lower Manhattan courthouse. Protesters bellowed for justice for Weinstein's accuser. A list of possible witnesses promised potential jurors a glimpse of Hollywood A-listers. But as testimony in the former Miramax chief's trial entered its second week, something other than celebrity took center stage. The myths surrounding sexual assault, including society's assumptions about victim behavior. And while Judge James Burke insisted at the start that this case would not be a referendum on the Me Too movement, the issues that came to the fore as a result of that movement have dominated much of the testimony. The idea that women respond to sexual assault by screaming, yelling, punching, biting. Although that happens, it's rare, forensic psychiatrist Barbara Zeev explained from the witness stand on January 24th. Zeev, an expert witness for the prosecution, dismissed the rape myths that she said society clings to, that most assaults are committed by strangers, that victims scream and try to run away, and that they immediately report assaults. The day before, defense attorney Donna Rotuno had quizzed the first accuser to take the stand, actor Annabella Sciorra, about her behavior on the night more than 25 years ago when she says Weinstein pushed his way into her apartment and raped her. Throughout her questioning, Rotuno touched on issues that Weinstein hopes will cast doubt in jurors' minds, including why Sciorra didn't immediately call the police, 911, or a hospital after the alleged attack. While Sciorra's alleged attack occurred too long ago for Weinstein to be charged with raping her, the actor's testimony is key to prosecutors' attempts to show a pattern of abuse. The actual charges he is facing in this trial stem from an alleged rape in 2013 and an alleged sexual assault in 2006. Weinstein denies all allegations of non-consensual sexual contact. Prosecutors got a boost when two of Sciorra's friends, fellow actor Rosie Perez and former model Kara Young, testified about what Sciorra had done and said to them at the time. Weinstein, appearing to chew gum, watched the testimony quietly as the 7-man, 5-woman jury listened intently and took notes. But as the trial delved into these crucial questions about sexual trauma and its often paralyzing effect on victims, fewer people were watching than before. While spectators had at first queued up to gain access to the trial, interest appeared to drop off, after opening statements. Instead of a crushing crowd, there were empty seats in the courtroom. The protesters who gathered outside the courthouse during jury selection had disappeared, and Weinstein arrived without having to listen to demonstrators' cries for his conviction. And next, another quick article. This is from Billy Perigo. In the battle over the next generation of telecommunications, China is winning. On January 28th, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson decided not to ban hardware made by the market-leading Chinese firm Huawei as the UK builds out its infrastructure for 5G wireless technology. The choice was a blow to the Trump administration, which has waged a months-long campaign to persuade allies to shun Huawei, and just lost its closest ally. Although Johnson needs a post-Brexit trade deal with the U.S., he also promised voters a revolution in internet speed and coverage. His decision not to ban Huawei, despite warnings of the risk of spying by Beijing, reflects the importance states are placing on the competitive advantage in internet infrastructure. Huawei is to be limited to a maximum 35% role in the periphery of the UK's 5G network, away from sensitive sites like nuclear plants. But on January 29th, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo still urged Britain to reconsider its decision. In Germany, the same trade-off between economic growth and security is clear, with an added current of fear over Chinese retaliation. An estimated 900,000 German jobs depend on exports to China. I don't think we can quickly build a 5G network in Germany without Huawei taking part, German Interior Minister Horst Seehofer said on January 18th. And while new EU guidelines allow members to exclude high-risk 5G providers, they stop short of recommending a ban on Huawei. For the past century or more, the cutting edge of technology has been dominated by the U.S. and its allies. Now, thanks to years of research and design subsidized by the Chinese government, Huawei's hardware is cheaper and faster than that of its rivals. That could have lasting effects across the board for U.S. diplomacy. And as China's sway grows, the Washington-London link is unlikely to be the only special relationship to come under strain. And I'll finish today's program with as much of this essay to follow as I can get in. It's written by James Wallman, entitled, Do You Have Enough Time? In the 2010s, we worried about too much stuff. A growing awareness of consumerism's effect on the environment and a desire to broadcast our lives on social media led us to prioritize experience over things, and millions turned to Marie Kondo and minimalism. Now we've started to worry about something new, too little time. Psychologists have found that experiences are more likely than material goods to deliver happiness, another reason we were content to shed anything that didn't spark joy. But of course we must make choices about which experiences to pursue. The fear of making the wrong one, and therefore wasting valuable time, is something many of us feel deeply. There's some irony to this predicament. We have more free time now than we have had in decades, but for a number of reasons, it doesn't feel that way. In his 2019 book, Spending Time, Daniel S. Hammermisch explains that while our lifespans have gotten a little bit longer, 13% since 1960, our spending power has surged by 198%. It makes it difficult to stuff all the things that we want and can now afford into the growing, but increasingly relatively much more limited, time that we have available to purchase and to enjoy them over our lifetimes, he writes. Next, there's our cell phone addiction. American adults spend around 3.5 hours on their devices each day, trying to keep up with the volume of emails, texts, social media updates, and 24/7 news. And much of our time is contaminated time, when we're doing one thing but thinking about something else. Trying to get more miles out of every minute, scanning Twitter while watching TV, for example, makes us think we're being productive, but really it just makes us feel more frazzled. Add to this the ever-expanding options in today's experience economy. Think of all the pop-ups, plays, talks, workshops, and escape rooms you could go to tonight. No wonder many of us suffer from what psychologists call time famine. No wonder we're seeing books about reclaiming our time, like Bridget Schultz's Overwhelmed and Jenny O'Dell's How to Do Nothing, and about loosening the grip of cell phones, like Adam Alter's Irresistible, Nir Eyal's Indistractable, and Cal Newport's Digital Minimalism. There have been calls to rein in the attention economy, like Tristan Harris's Time Well Spent movement, but the factors that make us feel time poor aren't going away anytime soon. Tech companies, for instance, may have built apps to tell you how much time you spend on your device, but their business models rely on your continued use. People who feel strapped for time are more likely to be anxious or depressed. They are less likely to exercise or eat healthy foods, and they're less productive at work. It makes sense, then, that there's been growing interest from psychologists in the best ways to spend our time. Current opinion in Psychology's April 2019 edition was simply called Time. In my own writing on the topic, I have come to characterize experiences as junk food or superfood. Junk? Spending too much time indoors, alone, scrolling Facebook or watching TV. Superfood? Getting offline and outside, and as UCLA Associate Professor of Marketing Cassie Mulginer-Holmes notes in her 2019 paper, It's time for happiness, doing things for or with others, and staying active. Of course, these experiences require that we actually take time off. Not easy in a culture obsessed with productivity. After all, 55% of Americans don't use all their paid vacation time. But researchers say sometimes it's about reframing how we think about leisure activities. Columbia's Sylvia Bellezza, Harvard's Anat Kynan, and Georgetown's Neeru Paharia have found that a functional alibi can be helpful. We're more likely to go camping if we acknowledge it will be good for our productivity at work. Similarly, Kynan and Columbia's Ron Kivitz have observed that we often opt for collectible experiences that give us a story to tell and help build our experiential CV, as we like to feel we're accomplishing something. They have also argued that while we often think we're being virtuous by choosing work over leisure, in the long term we're likely to regret this and feel as if we've missed out on the pleasures of life. Time is our least renewable resource. Despite the stress our fixation on it may cause, it's good for us to consider if we're using it wisely. And the author, Wallman, is the author of Time and How to Spend It, The 7 Rules for Richer, Happier Days. And you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Go to sunsounds.org, that's SUNSOUNDS.org, and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Well, I certainly appreciate you tuning in today and spending the last hour with me. I hope you did enjoy the program. My name is Matt Rinn, and I'm a volunteer reader for SunSounds. This has been Time Magazine, and this is the issue dated February 10th. Thanks once again for tuning in, and until next week, be well.